Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Jeff Norman, Colorado-based reenactor and impersonator, former United States Marine, and former Department of Defense technical instructor. The title of his talk will be The Buffalo Bill Experience, which he will present in the persona of Colonel William Buffalo Bill Cody. It was given as part of the Durham Museum's From Nebraska to the World, Buffalo Bill's Wild West exhibit. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, March 15, 2016, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Durham Museum, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Jessica Brummer, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the Durham Museum.
Tonight we have a guest that has spent many years over many trails as a scout, a wagon driver, an Indian fighter, a buffalo hunter, Pony Express rider, and an international showman. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, straight from the plains of the frontier, please welcome the Honorable Colonel William F. Cody.
Good evening. Thank you for your kind invitation to have me come here tonight and share some recollections from my life. I'm mighty happy to do so, and I fully guarantee the sum of what you're about to hear is true. I guess it all starts with me being born back in LeClaire, Iowa in 1846, back when buffalo roamed the plains like a rolling black sea, 8 miles wide and 12 miles long. I'll tell you, it wasn't all that long ago. And I suppose my earliest memory is when my older brother Samuel died, and I was about 6 years old. He was showing off like he always did, but this time on a bad-natured horse that everybody told him not to ride, and he got twisted up real bad, and the horse ended up on him. Everybody's real sad, naturally, and my daddy decided we needed a change of scenery, so we headed west in 3 wagons and a carriage, and ended up in a beautiful piece of country in Kansas Territory, and it was brand new. And folks like my dad were picking out the best plots of land for when Kansas became a state. Got pretty crazy. Folks were even marking their spots with empty whiskey bottles. There were trade posts scattered about, and plenty of money to be made by providing supplies to all the wagons full of new folks arriving from the east. I'll never forget seeing my first wagon train from high up on Salt Creek Hill overlooking the valley. Dozens of covered wagons lined up, a big old cloud of dust, chock full of families and everything they own. Families headed west on the Oregon Trail looking for a new life, gold, and adventure. In fact, it was up there on that very hill when by chance I ran into my long-lost cousin Horse coming back from California. He knew all about horses and even worked as a trick rider. He could stand on a saddle, ride bareback, and jump on and off a horse at full gallop. My daddy just gave me 2 horses I named Prince and Dolly. And Dolly was gentle, but Prince wasn't broke yet. My cousin Horse, he jumped on Prince lickety-split. Before I knew it, he handed me the reins. Prince all gentle and ready to ride. The summer that my cousin Horse stayed with us, he taught me all about riding. By Jiminy, I got to feel more at home on top of a horse than I was on my own 2 feet. I tell you, I'd go to the trading post with my daddy sometimes. We were living on a farm outside of Fort Leavenworth. And anyway, I would play with the Kickapoo Indian kids while he was conducting business. And the Kickapoo were just one of many tribes that lived on the plains, and some were friendly and some not. But it was there at the trading post where I learned a little bit about Indian ways and even learned a few words. That 4th of July, we invited all the traders, trappers, and Indians for a picnic in a field by our house. And by Jiminy, I'll never forget seeing them proud and savage Indians dancing and chanting in their beaded deerskin clothes. It was magnificent. And as unpopular as his opinion was, my daddy believed that Kansas should be a free state with no slaves. And one afternoon at Ridley's trading post, he got up on a wood crate and said so. Well, politics was ugly back then. Not like today. And he got stabbed by a pro-slavery Missourian for his words, and he didn't die, but he was never the same and never did fully recover. He'd have to hide out at his brother's ranch or with friends while he got better, And this often left me, my mom, and my sisters all by ourselves to deal with a bad man who come by our home looking to finish off my daddy. They harassed us on many occasions and even stole my horse, Prince. Tell you, even with all this Missouri trouble going on, my daddy believed in schooling, and he got a school started up, but I guess that's pretty much where my story begins, like so many stories do, with girl trouble. See, back then when boys were sweet on a girl, we'd show off our abilities as providers by building them a little playhouse. Well, I had me a crush on Mary Hyatt, and I built her the finest house by the creek. And unfortunately, the school bully, Stephen Goble, he was sweet on my Mary. And I tell you, he proceeded to knock down my wonderful house stick by stick. Well, I didn't like being embarrassed in front of my Mary like that, and so even though it was 3 years older and a lot bigger than me, we would fight. And he was on top of me, giving me a real good whipping. I remember. So I reached down in my boot where I kept a little penknife, and I poked him in the leg with it. He looked down and saw a little bit of blood it drew, and he started squealing like a stuck pig. Billy has killed me. Billy has killed me. Steve was quite dramatic. But needless to say, I hightailed it out of there, being just as scared as he was and knowing full well, once the teacher found out, I'd get two unwanted whippings in one day. As luck would have it, on the trail home, I ran into John Willis, a man I knew who delivered supplies to the train post at his wagon, and he hid me out when Steve's father came looking for me to teach me a lesson, and you know what that means. Well, Steve's father wanted to look in the wagon where I was hiding, but John Willis was a hard man and wouldn't let him. So after Steve's father left, John took me home and suggested to my mom that she let me make the 40-day trip with him to a place called Fort Kearney on the Platte River in South Nebraska while things cooled off. Well, after some reassuring from John and some begging from me, she finally agreed, and I was on my first big adventure. Fort Kearney was a real busy place, a lot of traders, trappers, Indians, soldiers, settlers, all milling around. And it was my job to help John pick up and deliver goods. A lot of times we rode along with the wagon trains where I got to meet a lot of the frontiersmen, good and bad, like Wild Bill Hickok. He was the toughest, strongest, best shootingest, best fightingest, handsomest figure of a man I ever saw. And heck, his name wasn't even Bill, it was James Butler Hickok, but because his upper lip stuck out a little, men behind his back called him Duck Bill. Well, he grew himself a mustache, covered that up, and that nickname turned into Wild Bill, which was much safer to call him to his face. I remember one night around a campfire, me and old wagon teamster, he knocked me to the ground when he thought I wasn't moving fast enough to get his biscuit. And he came at me for more, and him being a lot bigger than me, I threw a pot of hot coffee on him. Boy, he would have thrashed me for sure if Wild Bill didn't step in and warn him. He was using some real bad judgment if he continued. I guess Bill took a liking to me because he protected me from that day on. Nobody ever bothered me after that. John and I would follow the North Fork of the Platte River to Fort Laramie in Wyoming West. And it was there where I got to meet my two heroes. Kit Carson and Jim Bridger, two of the most famous scouts there ever was. Boy, they knew these Rocky Mountains better than anybody. I listened real good to their tall tales, and I sure learned plenty from them. Jim Bridger's nickname was Old Gabe, but the Indians called him Big Throat because he had what you call a goiter. Kit Carson they called Rope Thrower, and he was just a little fella, about 5'4". But I tell you, he was one of the toughest and smartest scouts on the plains, and even got to hold the rank of Army General, though he never learned to read or write. And like Kid, I love life on the frontier, and I can remember most creeks, trails, and prairies pretty easy, and folks said my eyes were as good as field glasses, what you call binoculars today. I got a reputation as a real good worker, and I hired on with a wagon crew delivering cattle and supplies to the forts in the area. And I was brought home whenever I earned to my mom and my five sisters, because my daddy had since died from a cold in his weakened state. And I was now the man of the house at 11 years old. Kids were just considered small adults back then anyway. I worked on a wagon train until I was about 13. Someone discovered gold up in the Rocky Mountains. So I headed out to an area, what you call Denver today, and on up to Blackhawk, looked for gold with all the rest of the 59ers. And I tell you, looking for gold, a lot more work and a lot more boring than what I figured on. Hey, So after doing that a couple months, I made me a new plan and headed back to the Republican River on the Kansas-Nebraska line to trap beaver with my friend Dave Harrington. But that didn't go all that well either, because shortly after spending the fall gathering up beaver skins, one of our two oxen dislocated his hip. We had to shoot him to put him out of his misery. And you might call it a karma thing today, because not long after that, I slipped up on Prairie Dog Creek and I broke my leg. Dave laughed when I urged him to administer to me the same consequence we gave our ox. But boy, I was in some pain. Well, since I couldn't travel, we decided I'd stay back in our dugout, which is pretty much just a log and mud box dug out of the side of the hill, and that's how it got its name. My friend Dave, he'd make the 125-mile walk to the nearest settlement. And there he'd get a new team of oxen and come back and drag me and our beaver pelts out. And he figured it'd take him about 20 days. But after 12 days of just lying there doing nothing, keeping track of days by putting notches on a stick, my solitude got interrupted by some real unwanted company. I woke to see a big old Indian hovering over me with some real scary war paint on, and I was certain he was there to do me harm. And I recognized him as Rain in the Face, a Sioux chief I'd seen at one of the forts. And I'm pretty sure that he recognized me too, because much to my surprise, he told his braves to spare my life, since I was just a papoose, the Indian word for baby. Now, what they didn't spare was my rifle and all my beaver pelts, but thankfully it left me with enough food to last me for a while. Yeah, the 20 days that Dave said it would take him dripped by like cold molasses, and my leg throbbed worse and worse. Wolves howled in the night, would often scratch at the dugout door, and I ate snow for water, and many nights I had no fire. I was certain that Dave had gotten lost in a snowstorm and was visited by the very same Indians that visited me, and I was feeling mighty blue. 9 more days had trickled by, and I was losing all hope. And I thought my mind was playing tricks on me when I heard Dave's voice in the distance. "Whoa, hi," he called out to the new team of oxen. I was saved. I couldn't stop the tears of joy when I saw him. And I sure learned a lot about friendship that day. Dave gathered up the traps, dragged me out, and we were soon on our way to Junction City, Kansas, where I'd get my leg repaired. And life is sure strange for being such a strong man. Dave would die the next spring after catching a chill one night. Well, I met my old bosses, my old wagon train bosses, Russell Majors and Waddell. And they gave me a whole new kind of job. Since it took so long for the wagons to get mail out to California and the train and the telegraph hadn't gone all the way through yet, they concocted a whole new plan to have riders carry mail by horseback over a more direct route. And they called it the Pony Express. And it was real dangerous because it was over real rough ground. And a lot of them Indians did not like us riding across their land. And I think the Help Wanted poster made all that pretty clear. Wanted, young, skinny, wiry fellows not over 18. Must be expert riders and willing to risk death daily. Orphans preferred. Saddles were made up special and called mochilas, mostly a leather seat with a hole in the middle put over the saddle horn, and on it were 4 pouches called cantinas that they put the mail in, and every kind of cantina had a brass lock, and only the station bosses had the keys. All but the best stations were just shacks with dirt floors, oiled paper for windows you could barely see out of, and crates for furniture. We had 2 minutes to switch out horses, and an average day's ride was 100 miles. One time I had to go 322 because my relief never showed up for work because he got himself drunk and killed the night before. Let me tell you, 322 miles of horse riding will make your butt sore. We ate, drank, and slept on them horses, and it's even been rumored we helped invent donuts because a hole in the middle sure made cookies easier to scoop them up from the ladies that offered them up in the streets that we rode through. But most of the time, all we really had to eat was dried up old biscuits called hardtack and some buffalo jerky. Instead of the 23 days it took the wagons to get out of California, we could go all the way, the 1,800 miles from St. Joseph, Missouri to Sacramento, California, in about 8 days. But even that proved not to be fast enough, because the telegraph folks put up the telegraph lines lickety-split. It was a lot faster to get a message to California by wire than by horseback. Yeah, well, I'll tell you. Now comes a part of my life I'm not too proud of. Civil War had started up, but I promised my mom I wouldn't enlist if she needed me at home. And heck, I wasn't old enough anyway, being 15. So instead, I fell in with a bad man named Chandler and some other men called Jayhawkers who'd make raid and steal horses from some of the same Missouri slavery men I blamed for killing my father. Well, once Ma found out about it, she said no matter how I justified it, I was now just a low-down horse thief. So I couldn't stand disappointing her like that, so I quit riding with those men. It's probably a good thing, because I heard some of them Jayhawkers got hung shortly after. Well, Mom died when I was 17, and it hit me hard, and I hit the bottle, and I became quite a hard case for a while. And after keeping my word not to enlist while she was alive, I found myself waking up after an evening in Tanglefoot whiskey, being a proud and very hungover member of the Union Army. Yeah, I saw my share of action, but I spent most of my time as a spy and a scout in Missouri and Tennessee. And I remember one time I was doing spying all dressed up in Confederate grays, came upon a farmhouse where I thought I would take my rest. Well, I got mighty surprised when I opened the door up and saw a big old Confederate officer sitting there in the dark, and he had me at quite a disadvantage. Without looking up, he said, "Son, what are you doing in them Missouri jeans?" Well, I thought my goose was cooked for sure. Just then he sprang to his feet. He says, "You old rascal, it's good to see you." It was my old pard Bill, Wild Bill, all dressed up and spying just like me. Boy, we shared what information we had on the Rebs over a flask of whiskey, had ourselves a good laugh, and whistled Dixie when we parted ways. Well, as the Civil War was winding down, I found myself in St. Louis, and I found myself in love. Luisa Federici, my Lulu, that's what I called her. Smartest pretty girl, prettiest girl I ever met, and I made no hesitation of my intent. She agreed to marry me, but wasn't too keen on me living my life very dangerously, so I turned in a new leaf. I tried to turn a new leaf. I tried running a hotel for a spell called the Golden Rule, but there's no way I could live that tame. I had too much adventure left in me. The Army was hiring scouts, and I hired on, and General George Armstrong Custer be the first of many Army generals that I would work for. And at first he made fun of my mule, but when it outrode his horses in the rough terrain, he told me later, "Cody, you had a better vehicle than I thought." He was pretty well regarded as a Civil War hero, and the public loved him, his men not so much. So he'd been known to burn down the tents of any Army officers who were late for his morning meetings, figuring they must have been too comfortable. I'll tell you, the Indians called him Hardbutt because he could ride from dawn till dusk without stopping. He was pretty full of himself, big practical joker. He liked to do things his own way, and that might account for him graduating at the very bottom of his class at West Point. He used to like to travel with his prized hunting dogs and a beautiful Indian maiden named Mona Sita that he said was his translator. But we all found that to be curious because she couldn't speak a lick of English. Well, things were getting real dangerous now between the Army and the Indians. For getting their land taken, the Indians were attacking wagon trains and settlements, homesteads. And for them doing that, the Army was attacking Indian villages, sometimes the nearest one, guilty or not. It was one bad circle. And it started to make my Lulu pretty nervous, so once again, I surrendered to her daily suggesting. For me to find a safer way to make my fortune, a man I knew named William Rose had plans to build a town just where the railroad was going to come through, and he'd be glad to have me as a partner. I was going to own a town. We decided to name it Rome, certainly it would gain the same stature as the original. We cleared it, staked out the lots, and just daydreamed how we'd spend all our future wealth. Well, instead, a fancy-dressed man named Dr. Webb showed up, wanting to be our partner, saying it would be in our best interest to work with him. But we weren't about to be tricked into taking on another partner, no sir, and promptly turned him away. And that turned out to be bad judgment on our parts, Because it turns out he worked for the Kansas Pacific Railroad, and it was his job to find good spots for railroad towns. He proceeded to start a town just a mile down the creek called Hays City. And that's right where the railroad stop ended up being. And it got a reputation as a pretty lively town. It was even home to the very first Boot Hill Cemetery. And folks say it was hard to be an outlaw there because there weren't no laws to be outside of. Finally took hiring Wild Bill, a sheriff, to try and keep the peace. But whatever citizens my town of Rome had skedaddled to Hays City like a shot. And I was now the proud owner of an empty town. But luckily I owned two other things. My 50 caliber Springfield rifle. I named Lucretia Borgia after a deadly female assassin I had seen in a play once. And my horse, Brigham. Brigham was fearless when chasing herds of buffalo. Lucretia Borgia rarely missed her mark. This Webb fellow turned out not to be the bad person I was so suspicious of. He even gave me a job in Kay City, clearing land. And my fine hunting horse, Brigham, was now relegated to pulling a plow. One afternoon on the way to Fort Hays, came upon some army officers who were chasing a small herd of buffalo about a mile out. Well, they weren't very impressed with either me or my unsaddled plow horse, Brigham, and they proceeded to tease me that they would be kind enough to save me a little bit of buffalo meat. All they wanted was the tongues, because buffalo tongue was a big dinner treat back then. Well, I let them have their fun. But I could see right away they went about chasing them buffalo the whole wrong way. And I guess even my horse Brigham got bored of their incompetence, because he raced me right up next to the herd. And I brought down all 11 of them with 12 shots. Pretty good shooting, if I say so myself. Boy, those army officers were sure not so full of themselves when it was all over. We came back, and I gave them the tongues they wanted, and we cut up the rest of the meat to take to the fort. And it was there where I very first heard the nickname, Buffalo Bill, and it stuck. And I'm sure glad that they didn't know that buffalo was the wrong word for those prairie cattle, because I could never get used to being called Bison Bill. I didn't have the same ring. But I decided to turn my buffalo hunting ability into a business, and I soon got a contract with the Kansas Pacific Railroad to provide their workers with 12 buffalo a day for $500 a month. Good money for those days, but plenty dangerous because a lot of times I find myself knee-deep in unfriendly Indian territory, the nearest help being miles away, me and my butcher Scotty. But I was getting pretty good, and they even made a poem about me. Buffalo Bill, never misses. Never will. Always aims and shoots to kill, and the company pays the Buffalo Bill. It's not a good poem, but I didn't write it. But as I was getting more and more famous for my buffalo hunting abilities, I soon found out there were about a dozen other Buffalo Bills, some of who were getting upset that I was getting famous with that name, and one such person was a man named Billy Comstock. He was a head scout over at Fort Wallace. And a contest was set up to see who deserved the official title of Buffalo Bill. He introduced himself to me that morning saying, Billy Comstock, the finest buffalo hunter west of the Mississippi. I said, okay, that's probably true enough whenever I'm east of it. But we were supposed to start at 8 o'clock that morning and tally up at 4 in the afternoon. I knew how to nurse a herd pretty good. And I got 38, all pretty close together. Comstock had 23 scattered over 3 miles. We came back to do some resting. Then we went back at it. I got 18 more for 56, and he got 13 more for 37. We came back to do some more resting. This last time we went out, I was feeling no pain from all the resting I had been doing. So this time I went without a saddle or reins on Brigham. And I still got 13 more for 69. And he got 9 more for not enough. And I was now the official Buffalo Bill. And being a man of his word, Billy Comstock, his name was known as Medicine Bill from that day forward right until he caught a Cheyenne bullet in the back at age 26. Well, When that contract was over, railroad moved on, took my job with it. And I was pretty broke now, and I had to sell my horse, Brigham. I hated to do that because he was a good horse. Last I heard, he's winning all kinds of races down in Tennessee. He never looked like much, but he sure was fast and had a lot of heart. And a lot of people, they hold me in contempt for killing about 5,000 of the 70 million buffalo that once roamed the plains. But there were no Burger Kings around back then, and folks needed to eat. Well, being broke, I signed back on with the Army, and I soon got a reputation as being the only one brave enough to take messages from fort to fort to fort to fort when it was so dangerous that no other scout would. And one time I had to go through 350 miles of unfriendly Indian territory, and I did so in less than 3 days, riding day and night. And afterwards, my boss, General Sheridan, was so impressed and thankful that he appointed me to be chief of all scouts. And I got me a new horse. I named Buckskin Joe. And as chief of all scouts, it was me and Buckskin Joe's job to find whatever the Army wanted us to find. Antelope, buffalo, Indians, water, you name it. And I might have been employed by the Army, but I did not take any guff from any of those young officer dandies. I remember one young major named Royal refused to send the wagons out with me to bring the meat back from a hunt, saying he wasn't in the habit of sending out wagons until he knew there was something ready to haul. Okay. So I found me a small buffalo herd about a mile out and ran him back full speed right through his camp. He shot out of his tent screaming at me in a high-pitched girly voice, "Bill, what'd you do that for?" I said, "Well, I have the buffalo provide their own transportation." "You can bet your boots and socks," he gave me wagons after that. There was one chief named Tall Bull in particular who was causing plenty of trouble. He and his dog soldiers, a band of really tough Cheyenne Braves who refused to live on the reservation, were getting real partial to raiding homesteads along the Saline River, especially after Custer just attacked the Arapaho and Cheyenne village on the Washita River over in Oklahoma, where Tall Bull barely escaped and his friend Black Kettle was killed. They had just attacked a homestead, killing some men, stealing some horses, and kidnapping two women, Suzanne Alderdice and Maria Weitzel. And it was my job to try and help save them if I could. So we rode over 150 miles from Fort McPherson all the way to northeast Colorado and Summit Springs. I tell you, this time it was kind of personal. Because not a month before, one of Tall Bull's Braves' bullets just plowed a 5-inch gash in my forehead and ruined a perfectly good hat. When we finally found their camp, our bugler was so nervous, he couldn't sound the call to start the charge even after 3 tries. So instead of waiting for a bugle call that might never come, I just charged in and everything went pell-mell. And through all the smoke and commotion, I could see Tall Bull riding a magnificent bay horse that I greatly admired, and I angled for a clear shot. And I finally got the chance as he turned towards me. And we each fired, and Tall Bull went down. And amongst the 200 or so teepees in his village, we found over 800 stolen horses and $1,800 worth of gold and jewelry in his camp that he had taken from the wagon trains and settlements. Tall Bull was one busy thief. Unfortunately, we also discovered that Tall Bull's wife had killed Susanna Alderdice with a hatchet, and Maria Weitzel was severely wounded. I ran into Tall Bull's wife as she was being taken prisoner, and I told her, out of respect for her husband's bravery in battle, I would name his horse, which is now to be mine, Tall Bull. We gathered up all the money that we found, and we gave it to Maria Weitzel that we were able to save, and last I heard, she got married to the doctor who took care of her wounds. Happy ending after all. Well, maybe not for Tall Bull. I was pretty much just killing time over at Fort McPherson, amusing myself with some horse racing that me and my horse Tall Bull always won. And I was introduced to a stoutly man named Ned Buntline, who was in town to give a temperance lecture against the evils of whiskey, a perspective that I never shared. But it turned out to be an introduction that would change my life, Because shortly after we made our acquaintance, he'd go back east and write a dime novel. It's kind of like a comic book today with words in the middle instead of pictures. About me, called Buffalo Bill, King of the Bordermen. Of course, none of it was true. But I was getting famous nonetheless. And I eventually have over 500 dime novels written about me, all of them containing very little truth. But I was getting pretty famous anyway, and when Russia's Grand Duke Alexis came over to visit America, I was asked for by name to lead him on a buffalo hunt. Boy, politicians always flock to these kind of things. There's about 500 people in this little hunting party of ours. Custer was there too, in his buckskins and that god-awful red scarf he always used to wear. And he was getting teased plenty because it seems that he had accidentally shot his own horse on the last buffalo hunt he was on. We all figured maybe he was trying to invent a whole new way of buffalo hunting by shooting his horse and hoping the buffalo would surrender so as not to suffer the same fate. Anyway, I led him down Red Willow Creek. I led the Duke, Buckskin Joe. And Buckskin Joe, he was off chasing the herd like a crazy man, shooting everything but buffalo. When he came back empty-handed, I told him it was probably because he's using pistols, so I lent him good old Lucretia Borgia. I cracked the whip, Buckskin Joe went to work, and the Duke got his first buffalo. And we rested a lot. They're probably still digging up champagne bottles over on Red Willow Creek. For the Duke's further entertainment, I asked my friend Chief Spotted Tail to have some of his Sioux Braves demonstrate how they hunt and fight and do a war dance and such. And seeing as how this display of Indian life truly amazed the Duke, I started thinking there might be some money in this. Another scrape not long after I get my reputation all the way to the Secretary of War. I was helping a small detachment of soldiers catch up with a band of Braves who had just raided McPherson Station, killing some men and stealing some horses. We caught up with them at the South Fork of the Loup River. Once we found them, they spotted us and fired. So I aerated one of them, and the rest of them hightailed it off across the creek. Well, Buckskin Joe, he had me in hot pursuit, ignoring the creek and all the arrows and bullets coming our way. But the soldiers' horses turned yellow and didn't follow. So me and Buckskin Joe, we retrieved all them army horses pretty much by ourselves. And for that episode, and some of the other scrapes I had been a part of in the past, I was awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor at age 26. Well, I got me a big idea. To go to New York. So I heard they made a play out of one of the stories that Ned wrote about me. Boy, New York is a whole different world. It still is. Horse-drawn cabs and trolleys line the streets. And except for a mounted policeman every now and again, not a solo rider to be seen. I was treated like a real celebrity. And I got invited to a lot of high society places. Folks seemed real excited at my buckskin clothes that were out of style in New York City. And they found my frontier style of dancing to be curious. So I decided not to show off my dance moves much. But I was curious to see some actor pretending to be me, Buffalo Bill. So I went to the play. They found out I was in the audience, and they insisted I got up on stage. I got up on stage. I was so nervous. When I went to talk, even the front row couldn't hear me. I muttered out something nonsensical, and I wanted nothing better than to get off that stage as fast as I could. An actor I was not. But still, the show's manager offered me $500 a week to play myself. Well, I told him he'd have better luck making an actor out of a government mule, and I headed back to Nebraska to do what I do best, scout and hunt. Somehow that next fall, Ned convinced me to come back to New York and try my hand at being an actor. And in spite of my stage fright, I went. But this time I brought my scout friend, Texas Jack Omohundro, with me. And even though he rode with the Confederacy, I liked Texas Jack. He was a good guy, and he was a practical joker. He used to like to raise up folks' stirrups after they went to bed, so when they woke up, they thought they grew an inch overnight. That was kind of fun. Anyway, we got there, and Ned was real excited to see us, and he wrote up a whole new play called Scouts of the Prairie in about 4 hours. Opening night was packed, not a seat to be had. Standing room only. Me and Texas Jack would get up on stage, and once we got up there, we remembered nothing of the script. I just kind of froze. Ned was up there trying to get us to say anything at all, and finally he just said, "What have you been doing lately, Bill?" Just then, I spotted a man in the audience that I had been on a hunt with. I said, "Well, I've been hunting with Milligan." Well, I guess everybody in town knew what a bad hunter Milligan was, because they all roared with laughter, thinking it was a part of the show. So I just continued to make up my own lines. It was a five-act play with no head or tail. And it mattered not which act we commenced or ended. Texas Jack and I would be up there firing away with our blanks, fighting fake Indians, taking red flannel scalps, saving women, saving more women. I like saving women. The crowd loved it. The Scouts of the Prairie was a hit. And I was hooked on show business. The critics were not kind. I remember one critic wrote, "If Ned Buntline took 4 hours to write that play, it's hard to imagine what he did with all that time." And during one act, when the fake Indians had Ned all tied up and ready to be burned at the stake, one of the audience members offered the Indians a match. But they were kinder to me and Texas Jack, knowing we weren't really actors. We continued to do our little play for a few more weeks in Boston, Chicago, and St. Louis, but spring was coming, so me and Texas Jack headed back to Nebraska. And while we were back there, we got the big idea. For next year's little combination, it'd be even better to have our partner, Wild Bill, aboard, and we convinced him to be in the show. Life would be good, hunting the spring and summer, and acting in the fall and winter. So I packed up my wife Lulu and my kids, Arta, Ora, and Kit, who I named after Kit Carson. And we moved to Rochester, New York, as I had become very fond of that city. But it wasn't such a good idea having Wild Bill aboard after all. He drank too much whiskey, getting fistfights with the stage managers and sometimes even the audience. And he always shot his blanks too close to the other actor's legs, burning them. He said it was to make him war dance more accurately. My old friend was getting meaner and meaner every day. When I sat him down to talk about it, he just said he thought he needed to get back to where the air hadn't been breathed once already. But I think it was more that the stage lights were starting to irritate the glaucoma that he was getting in his eyes. His failing vision had already affected his ability to work as a lawman because he had already accidentally shot his own deputy, Mike Williams, in the dark back in Abilene, Kansas. But for whatever reason, we parted as friends that day, and that would be the last time I'd see him because he'd get shot in the back a couple years later by that no-good weasel Jack McCall in Deadwood, South Dakota in 1876. And I remember very well it was 1876 because that was the year that my beloved Kit would die from scarlet fever. And in a welcome distraction, I was requested to come back to my old unit, the 5th Cavalry, back at Fort McPherson. Word had that over 800 Cheyenne Braves were fixing to meet up with Sitting Bull Sioux and make one big war party. Well, I was assigned to Colonel Merritt's cavalry to try and keep this meeting from taking place up on the Nebraska-Dakota line at War Bonnet Creek. They hadn't crossed it by the time we got there, so we waited for them from high up on a ridge. We had our cavalry hidden behind, waiting to surprise them. Well, they hadn't crossed it by the time we got there. And all of a sudden, I could see a small band of Braves racing towards us, whooping it up and racing right towards us in a real hurry. And upon further examination with my field glass, I could see that they were in hot pursuit of two mounted soldiers carrying messages for us, probably to tell us the Indians were coming. But we could tell that. We couldn't send in the cavalry and ruin the surprise, so I convinced Colonel Merritt to let me pick out 15 of my best scouts and join the fight. Well, when they got close enough, we made our move and got in the middle of it. The fight was in full swing. when one brave jerked his horse toward me. He was all dressed up like a chief. And he raised his rifle. He said, "I know you, Pahaska. You want to fight? Come fight me." I recognized him as Yellow Hair, a chief named that because of the blonde woman's scalp that he prized. Our horses raced straight for each other. We each fired, him missing me and yours truly accidentally hitting his horse. Both our horses went down about the same time because mine stepped in a gopher hole and faltered, so we were now about 30 paces apart. Well, I gave him that fight he wanted, and he was one tough brave, but boy, I got the best of him. And I would take his war bonnet and the first scalp for Custer. And then, not liking that too much, I now have the rest of the 800 Cheyenne Braves coming right for me in a real hurry. Colonel Merrick could see I was in big trouble, and he signaled the cavalry to come join the fight. And I was mighty relieved when I saw those Braves turn around and hightail out of there once the cavalry showed. Funny thing about that scalp. Back then, pale faces and Indians alike took scalps as trophies. And I decided this one might be good publicity for my show back in New York. So I sent it home to Rochester, New York. And unfortunately, the box that the scalp was in arrived just one day before the letter that I sent Lulu telling her what was in the box. She would reach in, and we would discuss that later. As exciting as all this would be the last time I'd scout for the Army like this. Frontier was changing, and folks were hungry to see the frontier. Indians were being tricked and cheated and forced to live on land that wasn't fit to live on. And the buffalo that I hunted for food were now being slaughtered just for their tongues and skins, and their bodies left to rot out on the prairie. Texas Jack, he died of pneumonia just a few days before his 34th birthday. And I got him a headstone up in Leadville, Colorado, that's still up there today. Everything in my world was changing. For the 4th of July party, the celebration being held in my beloved North Platte, Nebraska, near to my Scout's Rest Ranch, I offered to make it a real hoedown by including some of the riding and roping contests I held on my ranch. Cowboys had previously been thought of as low people and made fun of. And I thought maybe this roundup of mine would give them the opportunity to show the skill required to do that kind of work. And about 1,000 cowboys showed up to do just that. And some folks say this is the first rodeo, and I don't know about that. But I do know that it proved to be the model for my Buffalo Bill's Wild West show. And the next year, the audiences would get to see that vision come to life. A vision inspired long ago by my cousin Horace's trick riding and the show that Spotted Tail put on for the Russian Duke. I tell you, I wanted it to be real big. With all the cowboys, Indians, buffalo, even the Deadwood Stagecoach to show what the frontier was really like. So in nearby Columbus in May, I started rehearsals, and 9 days later, we would make our debut in my beloved Omaha. And little did we suspect, on May 19th, 1883, that Omaha would be the birthplace of an international phenomenon that would forever define how the world would see the American frontier. Wild Bill tried to do something similar just a couple years before he died up in Niagara Falls. But that particular venture went bad when a so-called trained bear in the show smelled some sausages cooking nearby and ran through the panicking crowd to get to him. Well, I guess Bill and his partners had neglected to budget for a fence because all the other animals got loose as well. And the next few days were spent rounding them up all over town. As good as he was with his fists and his pistols, Wild Bill was a terrible businessman. But my show got to be such a success, it required 3 long trains to pull the hundreds of animals, people, and props. And in big outdoor arenas all across America, we'd show folks how the Indians live, stagecoach robberies, buffalo hunts, trick riding, and maybe best of all, the sweetheart of my show. My little missy, that's what I call her. Sharpshooter Annie Oakley. Annie was born Phoebe Ann Moses and was handed from family to family when her pa died and her ma ran into hard times. But somewhere along the line, she learned she was a pretty good shot, and she got to be in pretty much demand by some of the more selective restaurant owners whose upscale clientele preferred not to pick out buckshot from their dinner. And at 15, she got put up in a shooting contest against a well-known shot named Frank Butler. And she won shooting a rifle that was almost bigger than she was. She was only 4'11". And she ended up marrying Frank a year later. So I guess maybe Frank won after all. But they were both joined by a show. And everybody loved Annie. Annie was a big hit. First female international superstar. From 90 feet away, Frank would hold a playing card sideways in his very trusting fingers, and Annie would shoot it and split the card and hit both halves before they hit the ground. They would stay married for 50 years. When Annie finally died, Frank stopped eating and died 18 days later. And it was only because of Annie being in the show that Sitting Bull, that chief that wiped out Custer all those years ago, he joined the show. Well, he was hard to read sometimes. A lot of times, he wanted it in writing that he got all the profits from the sale of his autographed pictures. And just when he thought he was getting greedy, he was giving all the money away to the orphans and the street kids that I always admitted free to my shows. I'll tell you something not a lot of people know about Sitting Bull. As a young brave, he was very unremarkable. And his Indian name was Slow. I bet he's glad they changed it, because Chief Slow does not sound very scary. And he's not the only Indian that changed his name. His friend Crazy Horse, before he had his vision, his name was Curly. So at one point in time, Custer could have been wiped out by Slow and Curly. That would have been embarrassing. I tell you, Chief would only stay with the show for about a year, but my former foe was now my friend. And we exchanged gifts when he left. I gave him one of my best horses and a sombrero. I was brought along a big old band and had him start every show with a Star-Spangled Banner. This is 50 years before it became our national anthem. And some folks credit me with it becoming such and why it's still played at the beginning of a lot of events. So you can think of me when you're trying to hit them high notes. Everybody in my show got paid the same. I was one of the world's first equal opportunity employers. Cowboys, Indians, musicians, women, everybody got paid the same. Speaking of equality, I would stand with my friend from Rochester, Susan B. Anthony. And I would stand up with her and advocate for the women's right to vote 20 years before it came law. Government tried to take some of the Indians back to the reservation once, but they argued that they were being treated fairly, and I was assigned the title of Indian agent to keep things legal-like. Across the ocean, England's Queen Victoria was making plans to celebrate the 50th year of her reign. She called it her Golden Jubilee. An American exposition was to be part of the party. My Buffalo Bill's Wild West was invited to partake. So me, Annie, 97 Indians, 120 cowboys, 180 horses, 18 buffalo and assorted other wild animals were to get on board a ship appropriately named the State of Nebraska, where it all started. And we were going to make a two-week voyage over to England. Well, old Indian legend has it that All Indians perish at the ocean's horizon. So they'd only get on board at the last minute and after a lot of convincing. And unfortunately, all their fears got reignited once we set sail and seasickness set in. We all thought we were going to die. I'd have been singing their death song right along with them if I knew the tune. But we got there okay. And England loved us. And we were highly sought after guests of all kinds of royalty. Queen Victoria would leave 26 years of self-imposed isolation in Windsor Castle mourning the death of her husband to come out and see my show. I guess she really liked it because this is the first time that a British monarch would ever acknowledge the American flag. And a lot of folks saw that as a real big deal. And while I was over there in England, I ran into a man who became a big fan of mine, big fan of the show. We'd talk in the tent afterwards. His name is Lord Baden-Powell. And he'd incorporate a lot of my frontier ways when he created the Boy Scouts a couple years later. In fact, some folks say that the neckerchief the Scouts wear today was inspired by me. Well, when I got back from England, I had an urgent request from General Miles to go talk to Chief Sitting Bull. Me being the only pale face, the chief would call a friend. It seems that while we were gone, a lot of tribes adopted so-called ghost dance as a way of celebrating the belief that life would get back to the way it was before the white man showed up. Today, you might say it went viral. It scared a lot of politicians. This would end up stirring up all the Indians again. Sitting Bull was still seen as a powerful leader and was going to be arrested up there at the Standing Rock Agency in the Dakotas. General Miles knew of our friendship, thought I might be able to talk to Sitting Bull peacefully and work something out. Well, while I was on the way, the head agent up there, McLaughlin, didn't like me being in the mix. So he sent over some of his men to try and delay me by getting me drunk over at Fort Yates. Was that, as you all know, this is not the first time that whiskey has ever touched these lips. So after the last one of them fell, I thanked them for their hospitality and continued on my way. This call caused McLaughlin to go to Plan B, and he contacted President Harrison and had me recalled, saying he had matters in hand, didn't need a showman like me to help out. But he surely didn't have matters in hand, and when his men went to apprehend Sitting Bull, he resisted because he was being treated roughly. He resisted, and he was shot dead for it. Well, as might be expected, a gunfight ensued between Sitting Bull's braves and McLaughlin's men. And once the shooting started up, the horse that I gave Sitting Bull went right into his show routine, dancing on his back legs and waving his hooves, just like I taught him. Well, needless to say, this scared the bejesus out of everybody, thinking that Sitting Bull's spirit had now entered the horse. And though I'm not sure what effect this had on the outcome, I'm pretty sure it added to all the excitement. And when the smoke finally cleared, 8 of Sitting Bull's men and 6 of McLaughlin's would lie dead in a shameful massacre of over 300 Sioux men, women, and children would result from that fracas. Not long after, at a place called Wounded Knee. I tell you, I've lost many nights of sleep wondering what might have happened if I had gotten to talk to Sitting Bull first. Well, over the next few years, we'd sail all over Europe, and I'd perform at places with my show in Annie, Austria, Belgium, Germany, Italy, Russia, Spain, France. In fact, it was in Paris, France. We met up with a young Thomas Edison who was showing off his new music playing contraption he called the phonograph. And he liked me and Annie in the show so much, we'd become his first movie stars when he invented the movie camera a couple years later. And in fact, we must have really made an impression on Paris, France, because they still have a Buffalo Bills Wild West at their Disney World. Well, I was the most famous man in the world. But a savvy businessman I was not. And I ended up losing a lot of money on some get-rich-quick schemes and some mining interests. And once I was in the bar, nobody bought around but me. I was generous to a fault. But one season, I made a lot of money, about $11 million in today's money, And in spite of my bad luck with my town of Rome, I decided to start a new town called Cody up by Yellowstone Park in Wyoming. I poured all my money into it, even built a hotel there called the Irma, I named after my youngest daughter that still stands today. But suffice it to say, I knew a lot more about buffalo hunting than I did about building the town and all the necessary irrigation and water it would take to get to town to get me to some big money trouble. And unfortunately, I had me wife trouble too. Seems that Lulu got a little bit upset when she decided to try and surprise me at a show and was informed by the hotel desk clerk that Mrs. Cody had already checked in. Oops. We applied to get a divorce, but judges wouldn't let us. Judges could do that back then. It's probably a good thing because we made up and stayed friendly to the end. Well, being broke kept me from retiring like I wanted to, and I did several years of so-called farewell shows. I was getting pretty old now, coming up on 70 years old, and a lot of times I needed help getting off my horse Isham at the end of a show. And I finally lost the show altogether when bad weather delays and bad luck kept me from being able to repay that no-good swindler and Denver Post owner, Harry Taman. And he foreclosed on my show just to make me ride with the Sells Floto Circus that he owned. I was working up a plan to put my show back together, but I never got a chance to finish. On January 10th, 1917, in a small bedroom in my sister May's house, I would ride my last trail and cross the Great Divide due to kidney failure. It's hard to know whether it was all the riding or all the resting. But I tell you, Denver, Colorado, North Platte, Nebraska, and Cody, Wyoming would all fight to have me buried there, and Denver won. And I'd be buried 6 months later that it took to get a suitable road to the top of Lookout Mountain in Golden, Colorado. And I'd asked to be buried there because you could see the plains of four states that I loved from my gravesite: Colorado, Wyoming, Kansas, and Nebraska. Mine's still the biggest funeral Colorado's ever seen. 25,000 people from all over the world line up the streets for miles. And people still come, I hear. Looking back, I suppose I had a life like anyone. Full of pride and regret, good luck and bad. But it's the kind of life you only get from chasing dreams, following your heart, and following your own trail. And it was a good life, and it was my life. It was the life of Buffalo Bill. You have been a wonderful audience, and I certainly appreciate your attention tonight. I thank you.
Thank you. You've been listening to a program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Jeff Norman, Colorado-based reenactor and impersonator, former United States Marine, and former Department of Defense technical instructor. The title of his talk was The Buffalo Bill Experience, which he presented in the persona of Colonel William Buffalo Bill Cody. It was given as part of the Durham Museum's From Nebraska to the World, Buffalo Bill's Wild West exhibit. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, March 15, 2016, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Jessica Brummer, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the Durham Museum, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.